Welcome to the Virginia is for Laughers podcast, brought to you by X2 Comedy. If you're looking to get more out of your Shenandoah Valley experience, then this is the podcast for you. You'll meet interesting people, musicians, and comedians that perform here and find out more about what you can do and see. Whether you live here or plan to visit, listen to explore what makes our unique slice of heaven. Now here's your host, Don Davis Womack.
Hello, Laughers. I'm excited to introduce you to Michael McCleave, a leadership guru hailing from Utah who has dedicated 35 years to the study and exploration of leadership. With over 30 years of experience, Michael has conducted workshops and seminars for diverse audiences, including college students, faculty, business professionals, clergy, volunteers, and has offered custom training sessions. He is an advanced accredited DISC consultant, helping people enhance communication and relationships within teams. Michael's expertise extends to Gallup's Clifton Strengths Assessment, which he has used to help individuals understand their talents, utilize them effectively, and overcome challenges. Since earning his strengths coaching certification in 2017, he has coached a wide array of individuals. His driving passion remains helping people develop better relationships, increase productivity, and become more effective. Whether you're a small business owner or professional, Michael is eager to leverage his expertise to infuse vibrancy, joy, and thriving into your endeavors. Welcome to the show, Michael. It's great to have you on today.
Hey, Don. Thanks. It's good to be here.
It is good to be here. I'm sure since this is a podcast about all things non-hiking in the Shenandoah Valley, I imagine the Laughers first question would be the one I have. What brought you here to us?
Well, I can imagine that's certainly a question they're going to have, because after all, there is a lot of outdoor adventure recreation in Utah, and there are certainly in Virginia. But this isn't about outdoor recreation.
No, it
is not.
This
is about all things not outdoors, if I understand you correctly. And it wasn't the outdoors that brought me here either. So what brought me here was an opportunity to be employed at James Madison University. That came out about 15 years ago is when that came about. And I've been here ever since.
Right. And at the university, you're not there now. We're going to talk about all the exciting reasons about why not. But that is what you did for 15 years here, is work at JMU. And what was your role there?
Yeah. So when I was there, I came here to help college students become better leaders. I was hired as the first associate director for leadership. And the focus was entirely on how can we help anybody in the student population become better leaders? One of the things that the administrators learned as they were looking at the student population and the opportunities students had to become better leaders was that it was almost entirely focused on those who had just the perfect opportunity. Maybe that was because they belonged to the right student organization where there was a leadership development program. Or maybe they got in with the right faculty member in the right classroom where leadership development was some teaching module in the process of a course. But the general student population didn't have access to leadership development opportunities. So they wanted to bring somebody in that would be able to create those opportunities for students. And what they really started with was an idea to create a program that would be multi-semester, not academically based, and would be focused in opportunities for students to basically contribute, give service, or in some way discover who they were, how they wanted to change the world, and then learn the skills how to do that. And that's who they were looking for, and they found me.
They did find you, and that is exactly how we met. Because you took a chance on me and hired me to be your first leadership specialist in the what is now called the Student Leadership Center at James Madison University, right?
And yes.
Yes. Yeah. And then back when I was first hired, it was called the Duke Center, D-U-X Center. And I didn't have the typical education or background in student affairs as advertised for the position, but definitely a numerous amount of transferable skills nonetheless. I'm curious, I think I've asked this question before, but I think there are people out there that lead teams and get candidates that don't necessarily have the exact box of what it is as advertised for the position. And they're wondering, should I take a chance on this other person? And they're probably thinking, well, what should I consider? I thought it would be really neat to ask you, what possessed you to do something like that?
Maybe I was possessed at the time. I'm not sure, but I think it all worked out for the good for all the years that we worked together. In fact, I know it worked out really for the good. You know, it's really interesting when you say that, because I was heading the search committee, and other members on that search committee, as we were looking over the applicants, we'd sort of selected the candidate pool of who we wanted to interview. And I actually asked the committee, can we sit on this overnight and let me come back tomorrow with a green light go ahead? And everybody said, oh yeah, absolutely, no problem. So we did that. And the next, and overnight, I actually really went back to who we had in the list, who the credentials were. And I actually went back and looked at those that we had said, yeah, I don't think we're going to interview these people. Okay. I looked at them very carefully. And one of the things that I really tried hard to do, and this is my recommendation to your listeners, if they're in that position that you said, if they've got a team, they're trying to hire someone, or maybe they're just looking for someone to help them on a project and they're not even in a business. They're just, they want somebody to help them with something. My recommendation is what I did at that moment was I really tried hard to say, who do I see that's not like me? Because we tend to select people to be on our teams, to help us out with projects that are like us. They think like us, they act like us, they talk like us, they walk like us, because we're comfortable with them. And I was going to be starting up this opportunity at JMU with just me and whoever I was going to hire. It wasn't going to be a large team. It was going to be two of us. And I really stopped to think, the last person I need is someone who's just like me. I need somebody who's going to bring something different, who's going to bring some talents, some abilities, some capacity to think differently, to act differently, and to be different. And so I went back to the letters of the cover letters that were on the applicants. I looked at the credentials. And one of the things that stood out to me in your cover letter was the way you expressed yourself in that cover letter was just really critical. I read that and I said, here's a person we've overlooked, because here's a person who's going to bring something I've not seen in any of the other candidates. Mm. And I see somebody here who's not like me. Mm. And so I went back to the search committee. And I said, I love everybody we've selected, but I want to bring one more person in that we've not selected.
No, my gosh, I hadn't even been in yet.
You weren't even in the candidate pool. And fortunately, and to their credit, they were very gracious and said, yes, Michael, we're happy to bring somebody else in that you'd like to interview. And it was fantastic to me, because as you came into the interview, you represented everything that was in that cover letter. Mm. I don't think you represented coming into the interview everything that was in the resume. Mm-hmm. You brought that during the interview, but coming into the interview, you brought what was in the cover letter. You presented yourself, who you were. And if somebody's on the other side of this, not on the selecting side, as I've been talking about, but is on the, I hope to get a job side, my standout point is, okay, carry yourself in the cover letter what they can't see in the credentials. Walk into the interview like you're the cover letter live. Because that's who you are. Be authentic. Be genuine. Mm-hmm. Don't try and replicate all the formalities and the specific kind of cold facts, if you will, that's in a resume. Be the cover letter. And that's what stood out for me. And honestly, that's exactly what got you the job.
Well, that is amazing. And I love hearing that. It's incredible advice too, by the way. And he's right. We couldn't be more different.
Opposite sides of the same coin.
Which was a blessing and a curse, but both in good ways as a blessing and a curse.
Absolutely.
Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, very, you know, very
we
true.
Would challenge each other's thinking because we thought so differently.
Yes. Yes. You know, there were many experiences that we had where I was coming at a project from a very analytical, very thoughtful, having tried to ask all the questions and get all the right information. And in our conversations about that, you would come at it from, but how are the students going to feel? Mm-hmm. Are they going to have fun? Mm-hmm. Are they going to enjoy this experience? Or is it going to be just like they're sitting in class again? And the last thing we wanted to do is to create another classroom experience.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it was great. We had some great times, some great experiences together.
Me too. Absolutely. What, 7 years or six or seven?
It was about six.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a really exciting time. That was also at the same time that my son was getting recruited
yes.
all over the country to play college football. Mm-hmm. So we got to have some fun discussions about that because you enjoyed sports or still do, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there was a time in my life when I actually was an advisor to a cheerleading squad in college.
Okay.
And so it really connected me more to the world of sports than I had been before that. And so to have that opportunity to get a little connected again through the work that you were doing and the times that you spent with your son and the weekends that you're off at football games, that was fun times.
Yes. And again, thank you for your support on that. Because sometimes we would have weekend events. I mean, that we worked with students a lot during the week, but sometimes mm-hmm. have retreats and different things that would happen. And I just so appreciate your leadership and being so supportive of such a unique journey that this young man was taking. And we were, you know, on the front row of all of that. And you could have said, no, you need to be at work. I don't care, basically. But you know, did the opposite.
And it's easy for me. It has become easier for me to do that over the years, Don, because I've come to realize and understand that when people come to work, when people come to become a part of an organization, they're not just bringing their work selves. They're bringing their whole life. Mm-hmm. Now, people do try and, categorize and they try and segment parts of their life off. And there's an appropriateness to that. But as a leader of a team, as a business owner, when you've got employees, one of the things that you cannot forget is the whole person is there at work with you. Mm-hmm. And the more you can help the whole person, the far more effective you will be able to develop that team because they recognize that. I think one of the reasons why you and I connected well at work was in large part because of that kind of connection and relationship I was willing to afford and say, I know you have a family. I know you have a commitment to your son's future and his development. And that's important to me too. And if I'm able to support you in that, what I know is going to happen in return is you're going to help support the work when mm-hmm. you're able to be at work. Mm-hmm. And so the more I can offer that opportunity, again, there's limits and there's boundaries to that, of course, but mm-hmm. to the degree that you can do that, you're helping to develop the whole person. And when the whole person develops, there's more of the person that can contribute to whatever it is you're trying to accomplish.
Yes, you did that with that. And then I decided to get into acting again.
There you are, coming up with another wild idea. Wasn't the first.
Nor will it be the last. And then I started pursuing comedy and decided to take the leap to pursue the arts full time, live arts full time. And you couldn't have been more supportive of that either when I jumped ship.
Well, you know, Don, one of the things that I see with people is when their passion and their heart is in something, no matter what you're trying to do, you're not going to get it. You can't stop that from happening in any meaningful way. It only actually hurts things. If you can actually fuel that fire and help them, you end up creating a better workspace for them while they're going through it, as well as for everybody else on the team. If I had, I just really felt like at the time, if I had pushed back and said, no, Don, I insist you be here at this event, or I insist that you do this, or no, you can't go to that football game with your son. It creates a tension. Mm-hmm. You are mature. You are professional. You would have handled that really, really well, but it also would have created just a little bit of friction and a little bit of tension. And you would have not been as willing to step in at some of those long evenings when the program went later than we had expected, or needing to contribute in ways that were outside your typical job description. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things, you start accepting a willingness to mm-hmm. do that, not because I'm insisting or demanding. It's actually the opposite. It's because I've offered you the room and the space to live your life. Mm-hmm. And that opens up your willingness to say, I like to contribute here too. I want to give back too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's amazing what happens when you give that. Then it's that kind of give and take.
Yeah. The Dine and Learn program comes to mind, and pouring extra creativity into that is really a heart of gratitude for the support that you provided. And so I would spend extra time and creativity to come up with new programs or add depth to programs because I felt thankful.
Right. Yeah. It's a natural human inclination that when you receive something, you want to be able to give back. And as a boss, as a business owner, when you give for your employees, they want to give back.
Yeah, this is going to be so exciting, laughers. We have had so many meetings about this topic. And now, because I jumped ship and decided to do this whole crazy comedy journey, now we're here talking about his new adventure. He has opened up his own business called Black Box Leadership. And so I want to get into just some of your leadership philosophies and ask you some questions about how you can help people. And I think I want to start with, can you share a pivotal moment or experience that sparked your interest in leadership, ultimately leading you to the current path in Black Box Leadership?
Well, the most pivotal moment has to come back when, I mean, way too many years ago. I'm not quite gray hairs because I don't think I'm going to get gray.
He's very ginger, laughers. So, yeah, if you've never seen him,
probably not going to go gray, but I've got too many gray type hairs that for me to really say, you know, going way, way back when I was in, when I was in college myself, I had a very, very good friend of mine who said, you need to go take this class from this professor. Now, the thing that made this important is this friend never, ever, in all the time I knew him, ever gave me any piece of advice prior to that time and never has since. One time he said, go take this class from this professor. And it was a leadership class. It was outside of my major, had nothing to do with my major. He spoke so highly of it that I actually did the one thing I never, ever did. This is the only time I ever did it, is I skipped the first day of class.
What?
For one of the classes I had registered for, and instead went to this class that I had not registered for, that my friend recommended I go take.
Michael McCliff.
Can you believe that? I actually
skipped
that. A
little uncharacteristic of you.
Way outside the box, Don. When you talk pivotal moments, yeah, that's pretty pivotal. If I'm going to do something as big as that, I was way outside of my comfort zone on that one. But I did. I walked into that classroom, and on the first day of class, the professor, of course, is going over the syllabus, et cetera. And I sat there and I went, yeah, everything my friend said is right. I need to take this class. So back in that day, you had to have a physical piece of paper with an ad and a drop, you know, signatures and all. I had actually brought those to class because I was that convinced that my friend's advice was probably going to turn out to be good. And so I walked up to the professor, got him to sign the forms. I turned him in and I took that class. Now, the reason that's the pivotal moment is because halfway through the semester, the professor asked me to come back and be on his staff who helped teach the class. He usually had about eight to 10 students teaching the class. To do that, he said, you have to take a class every Tuesday and Thursday morning from 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. for the second half of the semester.
Wow, those are awful hours.
6 a.m. So for the rest, for eight weeks, in the second half of the semester, I was up in class, 6 a.m., twice a week, was on his staff. Now, here's the interesting thing. If you wanted to come back and be on staff in future semesters, you had to take that class again. So every semester you wanted to be on class, you had to take that. Yeah, every semester you wanted to be on staff, you had to take that class.
Wow.
I took that class and was on his staff 7 semesters.
Oh, wow.
And it was the same class. It didn't change. It was the same thing. I was committed. And that coming into that classroom from what my friend told me was the pivotal moment that I came to realize how much I enjoyed and appreciated leadership. Mm-hmm. It took me a while career-wise before I brought that around to actually work it into my career. But when I graduated from college, I knew I wanted to do that kind of leadership development work. But back in that day, there wasn't any real outlets or ways to do that. And so it took me a few years before I found the field of student affairs and working with college students and realizing I could help college students become better leaders and use what I'd learned from that college class and things that I've learned since. So that was really probably the pivotal moment.
Now you've have been in this field over 35 years. So I imagine you've learned some things.
Yeah, maybe one or two. I'd hope so.
I hope so too. What do you think are some of the most significant changes or trends you have observed in leadership during that time?
Well, one of the things that jumps out immediately is when I was first studying leadership back in that day, one of the things that was coming up was, are leaders born or are they made?
Oh, that's right.
Now,
I remember that.
The really interesting thing is, it's an obvious answer if you really stop and think about it, because nobody comes into this world and immediately starts leading. Mm-hmm. The question is really whether or not leadership is only for the privileged few. We weren't talking about it in those kind of terms back in that day, but that's really what the question was about. I find it fascinating that every once in a while, that question still seems to show up. And I'm intrigued that why are we even spending any airtime on that? Because it's an obvious, leaders are not born. Every single person who's ever been a leader had to learn how to lead. Mm-hmm. The degree to which they did that effectively is the degree to which they could have been a good leader or not so good leader. I've also seen in terms of the trends of leadership, we kind of shifted as that question got answered a little more strongly. We then kind of shifted to the whole question about the authority, top-down, strong, hierarchical-based leader versus a more informal style of leadership. So that kind of went on. And there was a shift to accepting more informal styles of leadership. But that really didn't happen until people started recognizing, oh, wait, if that's true, then that means managers of organizations are also probably leaders to some degree. And so then there was the debate about managers versus leaders and what's the difference between those two? And is there that much difference? And you got all of that kind of conversation that went on as I studied the leadership over the years. Now, today, what's really interesting is that conversation has shifted from management and leadership to coaching and leadership. It's actually a lot of it's a question about managing versus coaching. I think it's kind of the same question though, coaching versus leading, or how can you more effectively lead if you choose to coach rather than somehow be a person of positional power and
rather than
leading.
Authority.
Yeah, that authority piece of it. Instead, can you bring coaching, bring your experience and expertise from that perspective as a coach and help the individuals you're working with rather than just imposing authority on them and saying and insisting you have to do this because I'm the leader.
So you would say, I think it's safe to say that the current approach is more, like you said, coaching, which is a mentorship approach and an empowerment approach with challenge and accountability.
Very true. Well said.
Okay. Well, I like that trend.
It's definitely going in the right direction. And, and not only because of how it helps people feel, but because it also works and it works far better than what we've experienced in the past. What worked in the past was because we were in the industrial age with assembly line manufacturing environments. And people were basically taking what they saw working with machines and just applying it to people. Even the whole literature around human resources and the management of people was all based on that assembly line kind of approach. And we've moved away from that. Fortunately, we've sort of elevated our thought processes. We've come a little bit better. And we recognize, you know, we're people, not machines. Mm-hmm. And with that, we need a different approach.
I like that. And that's so interesting. We're getting the robots online. Now they're gonna,
and the machines are going to come back.
And the machines are going to come back. It's going to be the machines running the machines. next question for you. In your experience, how does the Clifton Strengths Assessment contribute to personal and professional development, do you feel?
I think that particular instrument is unique in the foundation on which it's based. There's nearly 60 years of research that's behind that, and that it's not a tool that is intended to define or label anybody, which means it's actually designed and its purpose is for personal and professional development. It's not intended to say, here, let's be sure we can identify you and all of the specific attributes or talents or abilities you have, and therefore put you inside this box. And when we need that to happen, we'll open the box and let you out and have you do your job. that would be a complete abuse of that particular tool. The Clifton Strengths Assessment is really designed for, let's be sure we open up your perspective on who you are. It's not about, can you become someone, something different, or can you become more of something you are not? You can't. That, and their research, Gallup's research behind that establishes that. This becomes such a powerful developmental tool because it says you don't need to become something you're not. Mm. Who you are is already enough. You just need to become more of that. And not only is that enough, but it's also so incredibly unique. There is not a single person anywhere in the existence of the entire planet, nor has there ever been, that can bring exactly what you bring. The unique combination of talents and abilities that a person brings to the table, when developed to their best, cannot be equaled or matched by anyone else anywhere. And when you start grasping that concept, and when you start understanding, well, what is it that's the unique thing I get to bring? Wow, you unlock some potential that is just phenomenal. And when you realize, if I can do more of that and start finding ways to put people around me who can do the other things, or invite them to do what they're great at that I'm not, now you're building synergy and energy and potential for contribution and collaboration in ways that cannot be equaled anywhere else.
I agree with that. I was a part of watching that happen. I took the assessment myself. We talked about that just between you and me. Then we would implement that
right. In
assessing the students that we worked with. And that was pretty incredible. There are a number of strengths. I don't know if you can list them all, but maybe just give our laughers a sense of some of those strengths that they would find and learn about in the assessment. Can you share that with us?
I can. So for instance, one of those strengths that you focus on is an achiever. Someone who has the achiever talents and ability is someone who's uniquely capable of getting stuff done, of actually looking at something that needs to be done, and then they excel at accomplishing whatever that is and finding ways to do that. But the interesting thing is, when you're really, really good at your talents and abilities and you've mastered them, you've turned them not just into talents, you've turned them into strengths. You've developed those talents. Now you don't just achieve, you're not just an achiever for yourself. You bring teams along with you and you find ways to help them do that. This plays out really well too when you focus on someone such as yourself, Don, who has woo.
And I got a lot of woo laughers.
Woo stands for winning others over. And that's that capacity to be able to immediately make a connection with a lot of people. And immediately people feel like you're their best friend practically.
Yeah.
And there's just this instant connectivity and
I love people.
Ability to socialize and to have people feel comfortable. And they're influenced and want to be able to engage with you.
Yes.
That's a powerful talent that I guarantee you I don't have. I have a little tiny bit. I can't say I don't have it because we do have the capacity for all 34 talent themes that Gallup has in their Clifton Strengths Assessment, but we have them to varying degrees. And for me, woo is way down near the bottom. But what I can bring to the table is
achiever, right?
I'm sorry?
Achiever, right?
For me?
Yeah.
Achiever is fairly high for me. I can bring a lot of achiever, but I also bring a significant amount of what they call intellection.
Oh, yes. And I agree with that.
That's 100%. That capacity to think
and
to be always recognizing and thinking through, always on mind, never quieting the mind. The mind is always active. And for me, because I combine it with strategic, I'm always thinking of options and choices and ways that we can go about doing things. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of different talents that people, like I said, there's 34 themes and the unique combination that people have. You typically have 8 to 12 that are going to be in your top set. And once you start understanding what those are, and then the fascinating thing about strengths themes is they combine together synergistically. It's like the jazz music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when jazz musicians get together and they're really, really good, they start creating notes and tones that can't even be written, mm-hmm. but they're real. They can be identified. They can be measured, but they can only come in combination with other notes that other players in the jazz ensemble are playing. Strengths are the same way. When you bring strengths together, you create new strengths that cannot exist in any other way. That happens with you personally in your top 7, 8, 9, 10 that you've got, mm-hmm. but it also happens between people. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the reasons why when you and I are working together for those 6 or so years, some amazing things really happen because you were bringing strengths that were near my bottom. Mm-hmm. I was bringing strengths that were near yours. And those were complementing each other and creating a powerful team and ways to get things done and creating talents and abilities that just couldn't show up unless we were literally collaborating together.
I really like that you answered this question that I'm about to ask. So.
You know, so, just a little foresight there, Don.
So other than our success story, can you share another success story from your coaching using this tool?
Yeah, I think the one I would choose, I'm going to choose a student. I'm going to call this particular student. I better use a safe name here as somebody that I haven't worked with before. I'm going to call this student Donna.
Okay.
Okay. Because I don't want to make any associations or anything. So that's the fictitious name.
All right.
But Donna was really, really concerned about the work they were doing. They worked in another office and they worked with students in another student organization. And they were very, very concerned. In fact, the supervisor they had in that other office actually gave them a review and said, "You are close to being fired."
Oh my goodness.
And it was not, they were beside themselves. I mean, it was not a great situation. Mm-mm. And we had the opportunity to have a conversation. And I suggested, as I heard Donna share with me the story, I said, "It sounds to me like you're in that environment, you're trying to play into weaknesses and not strengths. Mm-hmm. And what you're being encouraged to do is to fix your weaknesses." Mm-hmm. And if there's anything that I've learned that's really, really important from the Gallup's Clifton Strengths Assessment is when we try and fix our weaknesses, our best case scenario is mediocrity. Mm. We're just never going to achieve excellence. We're never going to thrive. We will not feel that sense of success and accomplishment if we spend time fixing our weaknesses. Now, we can't ignore weaknesses. We can improve weaknesses typically to the point of being competent, but we need to recognize, just get good enough that you're not failing. Where your success is going to come is to lean into your strengths and talents. And I suggested to Donna, if we do this, if we give you the opportunity to take the Clifton Strengths Assessment, and I'll offer the opportunity to coach you. I said, "You take the assessment, I'll coach you, and we'll focus on your strengths. And let's see what happens." Because what's the worst case scenario here?
Right.
You get fired.
Right.
You're already on the chopping block. So what do you have to lose? It was sort of a no-brainer kind of a proposition, because she really was up against it. She didn't really have any out. She didn't know what she was going to do. So she took the Clifton Strengths Assessment. We started focusing on her strengths. I invited her through questions and through some prompts and just showing her some different opportunities that she could take advantage of in her work with this other student group. She started leaning into those. She started realizing that what she really had was the ability to meet, not in large groups and not with the woo and capturing everybody's attention, but to be in unique relationships in small little groups. And much more personal connections, and to lean into that. She started doing that and they started responding, and their attitude towards her turned around. Her ability to then invite them to be engaged in the projects and the work and the things that they were trying to accomplish suddenly skyrocketed. And about 3/4 of the way through the next semester, she came to me in one of our coaching sessions and she said, "My supervisor actually gave me an evaluation mid-semester. And said, I don't know how you've done it, Donna, but you've turned this around. In fact, you're one of our top performers right now."
Oh my goodness.
Just That's doing great. Outstanding work.
Yes.
Yeah. Donna was about ready to leave her degree study program because of this. And after and through the Clifton Strengths Assessment and the coaching that we did, she actually stayed in the program and went on professionally to be involved in what she had hoped to do and the dreams that she had accomplished for herself.
That's an incredible story. I love to hear that. I'm really impressed with your website, Michael. I didn't expect anything less, to be sure. But and it says and goes into your approaches of leadership are your go-tos are the black box leader development model and the intent-based leadership. And I want to talk about those and give them each some attention. So first, can you tell us more about the black box leader development model you developed? What are the core components and how can individuals use it to become better leaders?
So that particular model was developed as an outgrowth of my master's thesis. So when I was in my master's degree program, I found out most of my colleagues took that particular program and enrolled in it because it did not require a master's thesis. It just had a comprehensive exam at the end. But early in the program, probably third or fourth week of the very first semester, professor stood up and said, we talked about the importance of a professional body of knowledge and research and all that. And then said, you know, if anybody would like to do a master's thesis, it's an option. You can do it. We actually had a debate in class whether or not it should be required. Okay. And that debate was, there were about, if I'm remembering right, I think there were about 20 students or so in the program. I might have the number wrong, but somewhere in that neighborhood. It was 19-1. I was on the side of a master's thesis should be required. Everyone else was no. And I think in part because they were
Shocker
afraid they were
laughers. The intellect once more.
And I think part of the reason they all stood on that side is because they were afraid they might change the requirements and actually have to, you know, take the master's thesis. at the end of that class, I actually said to myself, you know, if I really believe what I was just debating that I think was important, I should probably do something about that. And so I learned what the requirements were. I did a master's thesis, researching how do college students become leaders. That work really turned me into the passionate person I am about leadership development, because what I really realized was I really, really want to know how do people become better leaders. And the Black Box Leader Development Model is exactly my research. And then from that point in time, about 30 years of professional work with college students, with business professionals, with volunteers, with a lot of other people in terms of how are they becoming a better leader. It has six components. And the reason the six components come out of the research, the black box is a representation of the six components, because if you take a box and you put a lid on it, you have six sides. Mm. And so I use that as the representation for each of the six components. The first component that I'll point out is evaluation. In order to develop yourself as a leader effectively, you have to evaluate where are you. It's also the only first step. None of the rest of the things I'm going to say are any kind of linear steps. There is no step-by-step process in this model, because you can go from any direction to any other spot that you need. But you start with evaluation. You always start with evaluation. And you always come back to evaluation, because it's going to tell you where you need to go next. Mm-hmm. The other five components: discover your passion. Your most effective leadership is going to be where your deepest passion is. So discover your passion, know what that is. And I don't mean discover a way to be passionate about your work. I mean, discover what's deeply passionate within your heart and your soul. And that's where you're going to be your most effective leader. You also need to learn and live the laws of leadership. And a lot of people, and this is one of those trends over the years that people have shied away from, is that there are in fact laws of leadership. There are laws of leadership. There are effective things that leaders can do that are always going to be true. It's kind of like gravity. If you don't know the law, it still impacts you. Mm-hmm. There are things about leadership that are exactly the same way. You may not know about them. They're still going to impact you, whether you do them or whether you don't.
Right.
You need to learn what those are, and then you need to live by them. Another critical component to the model specifically is to recognize that in every space that you're going to be in, how to make change happen is going to be different. Mm-hmm. If I'm working in that manufacturing plant, how change happens there is very, very different. How do we shorten the time it takes to get the product out the door? How do we improve so they don't have near as many accidents? How do we lower the budget? That's very, very different than if I'm working over here in a nonprofit organization that is trying to provide shoes for children who don't have shoes. Mm-hmm. How we make that happen is going to be different than how we make things happen on the manufacturing plant floor.
That's true.
Learn how that change needs to happen in your organization or where you're at, and then you've got to deploy that. Mm-hmm. Now, the next component on this is, it's really the interesting one, I think. You have to be able to do what leaders do. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like riding a bicycle. Have you ever ridden a bicycle, Dawn?
I have, as a matter of fact.
You know, when you think about learning how to ride a bicycle, you could read about how to ride a bicycle.
Right.
You could watch other people ride bicycles. You could have somebody tell you how to ride a bicycle. You could do all these things. You could watch YouTube videos.
Yeah, I have quite a few of those.
But the reality is, until you actually get on the seat and put your feet on the pedals, you're never going to learn how to ride that bicycle. Being a leader and learning how to be a better leader is the exact same way. Until you actually start being a leader and do what leaders do, you're never really going to be an effective leader. You've got to do what leaders do.
Hmm. So in summary, those six components, and are they one word? Those were a lot of words.
No, it's not one word.
Okay.
There isn't a single word that makes that make any sense. No, it's just six different components.
I got you. And then we have the intent-based leadership as another go-to approach for you. How did you come to embrace this approach in your work?
So intent-based leadership came about as an outgrowth of, or as a result of the work done by David Marquet. He was a Navy submarine commander.
Oh, okay.
Who had studied for a full year in command school. That's typical. Take one full year, be in command school, and prepare to take leadership over whatever ship you were going to be assigned. Now, you knew when you went into command school what ship you were going to get. David Marquet was assigned to take the USS Olympia. That's what he went in. So you study everything about that ship, every technical detail, every last bolt, every little specific thing, every single personnel file. You know all 133 sailors. You know everything. You spend a whole year studying all of that. About 6 weeks before he's going to take command of the USS Olympia, his commanding officer assigns him to the USS Santa Fe.
Oh, wow. They just spent pretty much a year.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly right. Now, they were both nuclear submarines, but the USS Santa Fe was not the same kind of submarine. It wasn't configured the exact same way. So he ends up having to choose how he's going to lead. And one of the things that helped him realize what that was going to be is when in training, preparing before they're going to get deployed, in training, he gives an order that cannot be carried out. He gives the order for the engines to be accelerated ahead 2/3 or something like that in their training exercise. And the sailor literally just looked at him and just stood there. Because the sailor knew that's not possible on this submarine. Mm-hmm. I have no way to do that under the conditions they were training under. It was literally not possible. The submarine they were on was not equipped to do that. Mm. And so he actually looks at the sailor like, what's the deal? And the sailor has to say, there is no ahead 2/3, captain. Mm. Everybody on the crew knew this captain did not know what he was talking.
From that answer.
Yeah. He knew he didn't know what he was talking about. So what he did is he developed a way of leading that he later called intent-based leadership. It was vowing to never give another order ever. Instead, you create an environment where you are crystal clear about the purpose and the mission of what you're trying to accomplish. So clarity is really, really critical. Second, you develop competence and you're always training for increased competence. I've since coined the term in my own use of intent-based leadership that you need your people to be confident in their competence. Mm-hmm. And once you have their certainty that they're clear, certainty that they're competent, you then give up control. Mm-hmm. And not just a little bit of control, all of it. As in him saying, I will never give another order. He didn't give orders. He invited people to come to him to say, this is what I'm going to do. This is why I'm going to do it. This is how I'm going to do it. And he would say, very well, carry on. Wow. He didn't give orders. And it worked. It works. It's powerful because it turns psychological ownership over to the people.
Wow. That's a great example. Do you have other examples, since it's your go-to approach, that you can share with us on how that style of leadership impacts organizations or individuals?
I think one of the best ones that'll stand out and be a reminder for most people of this, something we've just been through recently, is when COVID hit. Mm. It was spring break at JMU. All the students were out on spring break. The university said, okay, hold off, stay an extra week. We'll figure out what we're going to do. And of course, what they did is they ended up going remote. Mm-hmm. I can remember we were in a staff meeting with my student team who was all about doing workshops, delivering presentations, meeting one-on-one with student leaders, helping them become better leaders. We had been in a staff meeting just before spring break, the Wednesday before spring break. We actually talked about how can we reach more students? What are ways that we can do this? And the ideas we were brainstorming came up. We could put stuff online. We could do virtual. We could do basically use the technology. And then as we were evaluating the brainstormed list of ideas, of which that was one of them, we looked at that one and people said, we don't even know how to do that. We don't have the resources right now. Let's take that one off the list right now because there's others that we can do better instead. Scratched it off the list. Guess what we were doing 3 weeks later?
Imagine that.
Imagine that. We were now remote. We had to do that.
Yeah.
Now, here's where the intent-based leadership part comes in. One of the first things I communicated to the team as we were meeting virtually on a Zoom meeting and figuring out how to do that, because we didn't even know at the time how to make that work. But we were sitting there in the Zoom meeting, and one of the first things I communicated to them is, our purpose, our mission has not changed. Mm-hmm. Still being crystal clear about exactly what we were trying to accomplish and their particular role in that. Second, I informed them, I said, you've been trained. You have received the knowledge and insights and skills you need to be able to do this. The only thing that's different here is the medium. So you have the competence. Now, my commitment to you is to continue to train you and to develop you so that you gain the competence in this forum online in a Zoom environment or however we're going to do this. Mm-hmm. So that was the critical key. Then I said to them, I said, now, we're still figuring a lot of things out. How are we going to reach students? How are we going to get them involved? I said, there's a lot for us to figure out. So guess what? You have all the control in the world to make those decisions. Bring your ideas. Nothing's off the table. One of my student leaders that was on that team came to me. He was going to do a 7 Habits for Highly Effective College Students workshop series in the second half of the semester. He was planning to do about 4 or 5 weeks instead of workshop series. He came to me and he said, I've been thinking about that. I don't think it's possible. We can't do that anymore. We talked a little bit about it. And I basically said to him, I said, I tell you what, I'm going to challenge you. Come up with 3 different ways that you think you still might be able to do that. And if you still don't want to do it, that's fine. But I'm going to challenge you to do it. See what you can come up with. So the next time we met, about a week or so later, he comes back and he says, I thought of an idea that I really like. I didn't come up with 3, but I came up with 1. Okay, give me
one's
your one.
Better than none.
Absolutely right. We've made progress. I said, give me your one idea. He said, my idea is, he said, I'm going to live the 7 habits and I'm going to do a video blog on it. And then we'll post little snippets out on Instagram. And then we can do longer posts on our social media pages.
That's great.
And we'll invite people to give feedback and stuff and, you know, try and create connections. I looked at him and I said, make it happen. Go do that. I don't think I ever could have come up with that idea.
Right.
I wasn't the one as the leader that was going to say to them, okay, now that we're virtual, okay, you're going to do this and you're going to do that. And that program you were going to do, it's going to work. Like, I could never have done that. I had a team of 8 students. There was no way I would have been able to come up with all those things for all the things they were going to do. And that was one example. They all did stuff like that. We had an incredible semester. What was really fascinating is I had faculty members who we had agreed to go into their classrooms and still do presentations and workshops. And I told them, I told every single one of them that was committed for the second half of the semester. I said, if you want us, we will still come in and do that virtually. We will still do it. They had a couple that said, no, they needed to change their syllabus. Others said, yes, please, please, please still do. They were scrambling for what they were going to do. And they said, oh, if you're going to do it, great. Please do that. I taught the team how to handle a presentation on Zoom. We did some creative things that had never been done. I had faculty members in that situation who came back to me and said, how do your students do that? They captured their attention. They had my students enthralled. They were actively involved. They were engaged in learning. And it was phenomenal. It was an amazing, the time flew by. Next thing I know, it was wrapping up. How did you do that? Intent-based leadership. I turned it over to the students. I made sure they were competent. I trained them on how to do things. And then they were phenomenal because they brought it together.
Well, that made that horrible semester a lot better. Let's just be honest. That was a crazy time for all of us.
It was really crazy.
In the whole world.
Yeah.
And you have now worked with a wide range of audiences, Michael, from college students to business professionals. How do you adapt your leadership strategies to resonate with different groups?
Well, one of the first things that I always remind myself is, how do I meet this person where they are? And this is one of those moments of growth that I had when you and I worked together. When you first helped me see there is a way to better understand people and relationships with people and how to connect with people more effectively. Mm-hmm. And I had actually done some work on what tools we could bring to students. And one of those was the DISC model. And I had gone to talent developments at JMU. I'd looked at DISC. I had taken DISC. I'd been in the workshops. And I walked away from there going, no, we're not going to use that. I didn't feel like it was very user-friendly for our student population. And I can remember talking to you about that and saying, yeah, I was looking into that. I don't think we're going to use it, but I really need something else. What have we got? And I can remember you look at me and go, wait, no, that's not what DISC is at all. Mm-hmm. And you brought some materials to me and said, this is what it is, because you had exposure to it before. And you showed me that it was produced by a different company and it was very different. Still the same basic concepts. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't any new material. It was a new approach, a new presentation. That set me on a journey to really in addressing the question you're asking me about, how do I connect or resonate with different people, different leaders, different walks of life. Because one of the things that I learned from that is once I became aware of who I am and the way I bring myself into this world and interacting with others, I now have a responsibility to connect with others where they are. Mm-hmm. So one of the first things I always try to do is I try to understand, what are they bringing to me in this moment? Not always, not stereotype, don't label, they're not always that way, but in this moment, this is where they are. How can I meet them there? Oh, I can see this part of my personality, this level of energy I have. I can tap into that. Even if it's just a tiny little minuscule part of me, it's there. And I can tap into that. I love the experience I have when I've gone into presentations and workshops in vast number of groups. I'll go in and I bring a certain level of energy when I'm at the front of the room and I'm facilitating a workshop and engaging with people. Most people will think I'm much more like you in those moments.
That's
much
true.
More of that very, very energetic, very people-oriented person. And that's not me at all.
No.
But that's what they need in that moment.
I see.
So that's what I bring. So when it comes to that resonating with different people, I'm always looking for how are they in this moment and in what ways can I connect?
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought up DISC. I think that there's a couple of different forms.
Oh, there's a lot of different forms. Yeah, absolutely.
So there's the DISC with the little eye. I think that was...
That's one of the most popular.
One of the most popular ones. And then the capital ISC is the material that I have brought to you from Dr. Robert Rome.
Yes.
And what's beautiful about that is it really does help you understand how outgoing and reserved people look at the world and how task-oriented and people-oriented folks look at the world. And when you understand and see the lens from someone that's so different than you, at least understand it, their decisions, how they respond, how they talk, how they relate to people, suddenly all starts to make sense.
It really does.
Yeah.
And if you add to that the perspective that, you know, people really are not out to get you.
That's right.
They're just out for themselves.
Yeah.
People act in their own best interests. They're really not, most of the vast majority, 90%, I don't know, vast majority of the time, they're not acting just to get you. Mm-hmm. They're just acting for themselves and their best interests and what they think is best for them. When you understand that with the connection and understanding of what DISC is about, you start going, oh, I think I can see different motives, different needs, different interests that they have, what they want. And now you can see, oh, so if I can have a conversation about this, or I can change the way I approach the subject like that, now we can have a connection and a conversation that never would have happened because we would have just been in conflict with each other.
Exactly. Also, it can influence your meetings with people that you work with and collaborate with.
Yes.
So for example, if you have a people-oriented person and it's a Monday meeting, asking them about their weekend, you know, connecting with them as a person, given a few minutes to do that. Now they're all ready to talk about whatever ideas you have. However, if you have a very task-oriented person and it's Monday morning, they might not necessarily want to talk about their weekend at all. They just want to get right into it and get to work.
Yes, absolutely right. Very true. Yes.
And that's a great segue into my next question, because many leaders struggle with communication and relationship building. How do you help individuals and teams improve their interactions and foster better relationships?
So one of the things that comes out of the DISC model of human behavior is not just a simple understanding of your personality and where you fit on the spectrums of the different personality types. That's a huge, significant leap forward. But the next thing that comes after that is recognizing that when teams come together, you're going to have a blend of all those personalities. Mm-hmm. And when you start seeing that, you start recognizing, oh, each one of these particular blends, they actually bring a unique strength, a unique capacity in the way that they're going to engage with one another, the way they're going to want to build trust with one another. And when you work with a team and help them start realizing that more task-oriented people want to see you do the job, do it well, and then they're going to focus on the relationship and then trust gets built. Mm-hmm. Relationship-oriented people, they first want to get to know you. They want to connect. They want to have a friendship. They want to have that social connection and interaction. And then the work can happen and they'll do really, really well. And that's how trust gets built. Mm-hmm. And when you help a team see that, the way that can be improved, wow, it can dramatically change their abilities to choose and identify how do we go about doing our work. Sometimes it's really, really important that we just focus on getting the job done and the task. And if you've got a team who understands DISC well across the entire team, you can have that conversation. You can say to the person who's really, really high people oriented to say, I really appreciate how you help us stay together and connect us in our relationships. What we need to do right now is focus on getting this job done. Mm-hmm. And that person can turn. That person can change. In that moment, they can go, oh, yeah, I got it. And they can jump right in on the work. And the same thing can happen in the reverse. When you work with a team in using DISC as one of the tools, it can be a phenomenal way to really help them improve their productivity, their collaborations, and just their social understanding of one another, which helps the team get along a whole lot better.
I agree with that 100%. 35 years, again, of leadership experience is a lot of experience. What are some of the common misconceptions or myths about leadership that you've encountered in your work? And then how do you address them?
So one of the first things that I had to learn as a leader is the leader isn't responsible for doing it all. Mm. A common misconception is that the leader has to know it all and they have to do it all. No, they don't. Because if I know everything and I hire you as an employee and you're not bringing anything new to the table, one of us is redundant. Mm-hmm. Who's that going to be in a typical organization? If I'm the leader, I'm typically looking at you, well, you're not bringing anything new to the table. Let's get somebody else in here. All right. What they're not realizing is they've misperceived that they're supposed to know it all. No, I need you to bring stuff I don't know. Mm-hmm. I need you to bring skills that I can't do. So that's a really critical one that it can be hard for leaders to learn and realize. Another one is that idea we talked about earlier with intent-based leadership is I have to control it all. Mm. And I have to dole out control in little tiny pieces, and only when it's deserved or only as a reward or no. The most effective organizations, the leader will give up as much control as they possibly can. And the more control they give up, the better that organization is going to be if they give up the control at the right time and in the right way. Obviously, it's not willy-nilly letting people go and run amok and do whatever they want. But the more the leader can give up control, the better the organization is actually going to run. And then I think the last one I'll share in answer to your question is that the best path to effective leadership is fixing your weaknesses. Mm. No, it's not. Mm-hmm. There's one thing that I pulled out of learning from Clifton Strengths and in my own experience is I don't become an effective leader by fixing my weaknesses. I become barely competent so I don't fail by fixing weaknesses. And that's important. So fix my weaknesses so I don't fail. But if I want to be really effective and genuinely excel and have the team excel, I need to not be fixing my weaknesses as my focal point. I need to be strengthening my strengths. I need to be focusing on that which is already good and powerful and strong in me and just get them better. Because the research Gallup's doing says that exponential growth that's going to happen when you focus on your strengths, we're not sure there's any limits on that. It could be, well, we just don't know about upper limits on those. Every time we find a leader that we think has achieved incredible results and can't go any higher, they take it another notch up. And we see that all the time. We see that in athletics. We see that in business leaders. We see that in so many environments where people perform at such amazing levels. And because they're performing at their strengths and they get better at those strengths, next thing you know, they're doing even better. And that's another one of those things of don't spend too much time focusing on fixing your weaknesses.
I think that's your answer to how you address the myths. Mm-hmm. And if I'm summarizing that correctly. Yeah, okay. Is. Now, with your extensive background in leadership, what advice would you offer to someone just starting their journey in leadership development?
Well, the first thing I'm going to say is discover your passion. Mm. Now, the difficulty with that is being the first step on the journey, if you will, is sometimes passion discovery can take a long time. It's not something that comes easily and comes readily. And you typically have to do other things along the way until you really start zeroing in and focusing and understanding, it wasn't this big picture thing. It's actually starting to narrow down. Mm-hmm. And that comes from experience and interactions and all kinds of things that go on in life. But a focus on discovering your passion and doing a wide range of things, getting as many different kinds of experiences to recognize, you know, I never thought I was going to be passionate about that, but wow, that's really exciting. Next thing you know, you've discovered something you didn't even know was out there before. So I think that idea of openness and being willing to experience new things is a really big part of that leadership development journey. One of the things that to be honest with you, Don, as naming the elements of the Black Box Leadership Development Model, I'm not sure I named actually all six. I might have only named five.
Okay.
Because I think the one that I missed was you have to lead yourself. And I think this is the other
pivotal.
This is the other beginning point for a leader. And your question reminds me of, I don't think I said that before. You've got to turn your leadership abilities inward and who you are as a person first. Because if you can't lead your own life, how are you expecting to lead and influence others? So it's sort of like put your own house in order, and then you're in a position to be able to be a positive influence, be effective at leading other people.
I really like that answer a lot, especially now with there being such a focus on mental health and taking care of yourself and self-care, self-love. It really is powerful because it transforms your life and then it will transform the lives of others. It's a ripple effect when you lead from within first.
It is. Absolutely.
Yeah. And we have a fast-paced and ever-changing business world now. Speaking of the need for mental health, what are some key qualities or skills that you believe every leader should possess or develop to thrive?
Well, I'm gonna cheat on this one.
Okay. Wow. So many surprises today, Michael.
because I'm gonna steal one out of your playbook.
Oh, excellent.
This is something that you taught me that I think in answer to your question is really something that becomes critical for every leader to thrive. And you shared with me your story and that backs this up. I'm not going to go into the story. I'm just going to share what you told me that was the lesson that stuck. And that is, if you can learn as a leader that expectations are your enemy and flexibility is your friend,
yes,
it dramatically changes how effective you can be as a leader. When you stop to realize, oh, I was expecting this, but I misunderstood, or my paradigm has shifted, or I now have new information, or so many things change. If you stop expecting and recognize whatever presents itself in this moment, mm-hmm. I can be flexible and move with it. I know what my outcome is, but I'm good. If we still find a way to get there, my expectations don't have to drive what I do. And it doesn't have to drive my demand of what others do. I can let go of control. I can let them choose their own path to get there. And chances are it'll be better at the outcome than if I had gotten us there by holding on to control and demanding that my expectations be met. I've seen that time and time again, that if I will let go and let other people find the path, they know where we want to go. They know the outcomes and results. That's on me. If I can choose that and let them figure out how to get there, the outcome will probably far exceed whatever I hope to accomplish.
Well, since it came from my playbook, I couldn't agree more. But I think another thought that comes to mind as you were sharing that, and one of the things I think people get hung up on, and I've seen myself get hung up on that too, with regards to expectation, is failure.
Yeah.
And when you dwell on what didn't go right or what failed, and you spin your negative energy into a never-ending downspin, you miss and can miss what you've learned from that failure or that missed expectation, because there's gold in there in terms of how you could do things better, or maybe you shouldn't do that again, you know, or that was a good start, but this pivot will actually help you get the outcome and actually be thankful for the times that expectations are not met or you failed. Those are gifts.
Those really, really are. So many times when you let go of expectations, you will find even better ways to do something or an even better outcome than you thought you were going to try and achieve. You might find that your original idea and where you were headed was okay, but there could be something completely different and it never would have showed up if you'd hung on to your expectations. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So when you can let go of those and be flexible along the way, boy, it changes the dynamic dramatically. And I think it's a powerful, powerful tool for leaders to learn.
I think so too. I'd love for you to share with the laughers some of the services that you offer now at Black Box Leadership and what you plan to offer in the future through your coaching, courses, resources, and workshops.
Thanks. I appreciate that. So one of the things that I really, really love to do, and when, That was one of the reasons that led me to, which I don't think we've asked the question yet, but to circle back to something you said at the top of the podcast, is it led me to retire from JMU. Mm-hmm. And that is, I really, really love working in one-on-one coaching and situations with people. And I really enjoy doing that in environments that are important to them and that they're trying to accomplish something in a variety of environments. So one of the things that I offer is one-on-one coaching. One of the things that I'm committed to is to not ever bring to that particular situation a solution before I know what the problem is. I really want to work with someone. And so one of my particular approach is to first have a conversation with people, sometimes even two or three conversations before I'm going to say, well, here's what I think might be of value to you. I usually give people choices and options and say, I'm seeing this, or I'm hearing that, or I think this could be of value. Where would you like to go? And so my coaching services are always based on that. So one-on-one coaching is one of those things. I like to bring tools and resources to them so they're seeing additional insights and information. So the Clifton Strengths Assessment, the DISC model of human behavior. I also work with the leadership practices inventory that James Kouzis and Barry Posner developed over 35 years ago and still find it legitimate and valid and useful today. So there's a number of different tools that I'll use and bring to the table. Because I've stepped away from the educational world, and I'm now also working with a lot of small business owners, I also bring another platform altogether called Profit Acceleration Software. And it's a way that we can sit down and do an evaluation and assessment for business owners who are interested in seeing, where can I increase the profits? Where can I change how I'm doing my business so that I can be more effective in my market and in my industry? And it's a really, really insightful tool. And one of the things that I currently offer is a completely free assessment. It takes about 45 minutes. We ask critical questions that are related to the challenges the business owner is currently facing. And based on that, we'll create a roadmap of the strategies that they can use. The business owner at the end of that gets that complete roadmap. It's an opportunity for me to have a conversation with them. There's no costs involved. They get the strategies. And my invitation to them is, if they want help, let's discuss how I can help them implement that with the specific tactics and actually be effective at implementing. If they feel like they've got what it takes to implement the strategies, fantastic. I've given them a resource of pointing out some strategies to them and they're off to the races. So those are a couple of things that I'm doing right now. I also do workshops for organizations and whether that be a business, to be able to bring like a DISC assessment in, to be able to improve communications, to deal with conflict. It might be, how do you unlock the untapped potential that employees have in the workplace? So there's a number of workshops and scenarios that we can also bring in. One of the things I'm currently developing that I've got 1/4 of it developed right now. It's called Flash Coaching. And so my business is all about helping people become better leaders, focusing on how do you empower people? How do you optimize productivity? And how do you accelerate profits? Now, the profit piece, I've got the program already all developed where the Flash Coaching is unlimited coaching sessions for 15 minutes each. Mm-hmm. So they're very short, very laser focused, and they're very action oriented. Mm-hmm. And for 1 year, somebody signs up and we walk through the 12 different strategies and the modules that they need. I'm developing that same exact approach for the people, the productivity, and the leadership side as well. I'm hoping to be able to offer those soon.
That's great. And you also have a blog I noticed on your website that has a lot of very interesting topics about leadership.
Yeah, I try to hit it from a lot of different angles because one of the things that I had somebody tell me once about not being excited and studying leadership because it wasn't their passion is, well, it's just so ubiquitous. It's everywhere. It's like to them, it was meaningless because where was the specificity? Where was the focus? It just seemed so broad. And for me, it's like, yeah, that fact that it is everywhere, it's in everything you do. It's in your personal life. It's in your family life. It's in relationships you have. It's in your employment. It's everywhere. It's so critically important that you understand what it is. And so I try to bring a lot of different angles. I try to approach it from many different perspectives. And sometimes in my blog posts, I like to create little stories. So it's a little more fun for the reader rather than just me droning on about some concept that can be boring after a while.
Well, you're a good storyteller, so that works out. That checks out. I like that. And as you continue your journey in leadership, Michael, and helping others, what do you see as the future of leadership development, and how do you plan to contribute to it?
Well, I think, I think one of the things that's going to happen in leadership development is we're going to come to better understand how you authentically bring people together, choosing to use the power you have. The one thing that I see, I feel like is really untapped, is the recognition and understanding that every single individual always, always has power. Now, most of the time, because the history of leadership has been from a top-down, authoritative, positional perspective, I have the position, therefore I have all the power. And we tend to think that that kind of utility power, I have a resource, you don't, therefore I have the power, is the only way that we ever see power. But the reality is every single person has power within them. That leading from within is what becomes so critically important. And I think one of the things that will come forward eventually as we really get there is understanding in the future development of leadership is really seeing that how do we help people realize that they have that power? And then how do we help them choose to use the power? Mm-hmm. In leadership development, my experience is people come to somebody like me when they've already decided and come to choose, I know I have the power. I need help being the leader now that I am one. And the thing is, everybody already is a leader. At the very least, you're the leader of one, yourself. So what power do you have? Because you do have it. And now, how do you choose to use it? I think that's a development that hasn't yet really occurred in all that's out there. And I think it's one of those things that will be untapped and that we need to tap into. It's one of those things I'd like to figure out too, because I think that's going to come as I work with people, whether in organizations or additional clients or service organizations, wherever I may be in providing help for them, that it's one of those things I'll start better understanding as well.
I love all of that. And as we wrap up here, how best can the Laughers stay updated with the latest at Black Box Leadership on social media or otherwise, Michael?
Oh, yes. Well, there's other things. You mentioned I've got my blog on my website. That's at blackboxleadership.com. And you can find the blog there. You can stay up to date with things that are going on there. I also have on my website in the upper right-hand corner, there's a link that says, get your gift. If you click on that button, I offer a gift to everybody that comes to the website. You're welcome to go there and get there. And that will also put you on the mailing list. And I send out information to people that are on my mailing list every once in a while, notices about blog posts coming up or maybe some opportunity that I've seen. Different things like that. So they can get on the mailing list as well. I also want to mention though, Don, just for your listeners, because when you set this up for me, I thought, I got to do something for Don's listeners.
What?
And so, yeah, I decided that this is not actually out in the public yet. I'm going to make it available. I think it's probably going to be at the first of the year before it's going to be out there. So, you know, like 2-3 months ahead of time here, your listeners can get a book from me. It's a PDF book that I have. It's called Fast Track Creativity.
What?
It's really ideally suited for business owners because it's 52 innovative ideas for generating leads in their business, new customers, new prospects, new potential. That's it's basically the thought prospect was take one a week. Implement one a week, you have 52 ideas. Now, maybe one of those ideas doesn't work for you, so you just keep doing one that you already did. But it's a really kind of a broad range of different ideas. So the way that your users can get it is through one of my social media contacts. If they'll connect with me on LinkedIn, and the way to get to me on LinkedIn is go to blackboxleadership.com/contact.
Okay.
And on there, all of my social media links are there. Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter. They're all down there at the bottom. They can just click on that. My Instagram will be there. They can click on the LinkedIn one. If they will connect with me on LinkedIn and send me a message, so direct message me on LinkedIn, tell me that you listen to the Laughers podcast, I'll send them the book absolutely free ahead of time before anybody else ever gets it.
What? Laughers, did you hear that? That's amazing. Thank you. I know that took some time to put that together. And I know him, Laughers. He went all out. He doesn't do anything halfway. So thank you so much for taking the time for doing that for our Laughers. I'm so excited.
You're very welcome. I'm excited to be able to give that out.
Me too. I'll have to message you on LinkedIn also.
Yes, you might need to use that.
I think so. Well, Michael, thank you so much. It's been amazing hanging out with you, hearing some of your story and having you share with us your leadership philosophies today. I can't wait to hear many, many more success stories of the people that you work with in this next chapter for you at Black Box Leadership. So thanks again for coming on the show. This has been super fun.
Oh, super excited to be here. Thank you for the invitation. I've loved it.
Oh, Michael, what else can I say? You're just great. And laughers, to connect with Michael, read his ultra informative blog and learn more about his coaching, courses, resources, and workshops when you visit blackboxleadership.com. And don't forget to message him and LinkedIn so that you can get your free gift exclusive to the laughers only. And then don't forget to nag that discount on Prepopsterous using promo code LAUGH15 at prepopsterous.com. That's PrepopsterouS.com. That way you can munch on it when you join me on next week's episode. And lastly, and most importantly, thanks for tuning in, laughers. Out of all the podcasts out there, you picked us, and we think that's pretty darn special, just like you. Until next time, keep smiling.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Virginia is for Laughers podcast, brought to you by X2 Comedy. We'll be dropping a new podcast every Wednesday, so check back for another uplifting episode. Come to an X2 Comedy show or let us bring one to you. To find out more, head to x2comedy.com. Be sure to share this podcast with a friend, and until next time, cheers.